With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The wet year helps the Colorado River, but Imperial farmers are still conserving water. A consensus plan agreed to last spring by states in the Colorado River's lower basin should keep sufficient water in the river's key reservoirs for the next 3 years. Despite the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation reporting an improved water outlook after the 2023 rains, implementing the plan will require farmers to voluntarily use much less water over the next 3 years. In California, most of the water savings will come from farmers in the Imperial Valley. Tina Shields, water manager for the Imperial Irrigation District, says, quote, "We're going to be aiming for unprecedented levels of conservation." That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. House Republican members urge a swift Farm Bill passage. Republican lawmakers in the House of Representatives are urging a new speaker to pass a farm bill. In a letter last week to Speaker Mike Johnson, a group of 61 members told the speaker, quote, "We urge you and the conference at large to be united in ensuring the swift passage of a strong farm bill." The letter notes that more than 92% of the nation's planted acres are represented by Republican members. Moreover, in 2022, the food and agriculture sectors contributed $7.4 trillion in economic activity, creating 43 million jobs, $2.3 trillion in wages, $718 billion in tax revenue, and $183 billion in exports stemming from direct, indirect, and induced output. The lawmakers added, quote, "The Farm Bill is a critical agenda item that must be addressed this Congress." Before he was elected Speaker, Johnson revealed a priority list that included a December vote on the Farm Bill, pledging to, quote, "begin negotiations as soon as possible." NAFB contributed to that report. Up next, we have more Ag News with AgNet West Brian German. But before we get to his reports, I'd like to remind you that we're going to be out at the 6th Annual Organic Growers Summit presented by Western Growers and the Organic Produce Network. It's being held November 29th through the 30th of this year. If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit organicgrowersummit.com. And now, back to the news.
A survey of California dairy nutritionists on byproduct usage in rations revealed some interesting results. Cooperative Extension Dairy Farm Advisor Jennifer Hege explained what they found as popular byproducts among dairies.
Not surprising, almond hulls and whole cottonseed were the two most frequently reported fed byproducts in the state. Obviously, almond hulls make sense. We do have a lot of almond hulls to feed. One thing I thought was interesting, and I've done some feeding surveys over the years, but for the first time, almond hulls and shells made the top 10 list. So almond hulls and shells, that's basically just a definition. If it doesn't meet the quality of an almond hull, it's designated as hull and shell. And so the designation is if it's more than 15% crude fiber, it has to be sold at that lesser definition. So I just thought that was interesting. You know, almond hulls were number one, but then almond hulls and shell, came in at number six. So both very, very high.
UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is hosting an organic agriculture workshop in Yuba City next week. The program will begin at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, November 7th at the Sutter Yuba UC Cooperative Extension Office. Rice Farm Advisor Whitney Brim DeForest will begin with a presentation on pest management in organic rice production. That will be followed by a discussion on growing organic almonds in the Sacramento Valley, along with information on integrating livestock into organic cropping systems. Agronomy Farm Advisor Sarah Light will also be making a presentation on cover cropping and weed management considerations. Other topics of discussion will include organic nitrogen management in annual cropping systems and DPR's roadmap for sustainable pest management and what that means for organic farmers. More information about the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Water, a precious natural resource and essential for all farmers. But how much is too much or too little? And when is the best time to irrigate? Irrigation Water Management can answer those and other dilemmas by combining your knowledge of your farm with technical knowledge of plant, soil, and today's technology. At USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, we've seen farmers like you add 5, 10, 15% or more to your water savings using IWM. NRCS specialists can help you optimize water savings through management. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
Well, in today's livestock news, certified organic livestock and poultry producers here in the U.S. will soon have new production standards to follow. The USDA has unveiled new rules for organic livestock producers that establish clear, strong, and consistent standards for organic livestock and poultry production. With more about it, here's Gary Crawford.
If you are an organic livestock or poultry producer, you've been waiting quite a while, a long time, for the USDA to craft a set of national regulations that would govern the conditions under which certified organic livestock and poultry would be raised. But the wait is over. USDA has just published the final rules.
This is the most significant update in organic regulations in over 30 years.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack unveiling the new rules for reporters. The set of rules has less to do with what producers feed their animals, what medicines can be used on them and such, more to do with how the animals are cared for example.
It establishes minimum outdoor space requirements and ready access to outdoors for livestock and poultry. The rule carries forward indoor and outdoor living condition requirements, sufficient space for animals to move freely. Bedding that is in a large area, comfortable and hygienic. So specific density for poultry requirements.
When these rules take full effect, producers won't be able to market their products as certified organic unless they meet those humane care standards. And so
this rule makes organic the gold standard for animal care.
Nate Powell Palm is a Montana organic producer, chair of the National Organic Standards Board. He told us most organic producers realize these new rules will boost interest in and sales of their organic products.
Everybody wants it. Farmers want it. Consumers want it. Organic certifiers want it. It provides excellent consistency so that everyone knows that all producers raising organic livestock are doing it in the same exceptionally high-quality environment.
Several farm groups have praised the rules. Also, there's been praise from lawmakers, including Maine Representative Shelley Pingree.
The USDA and others are doing so much, importantly, to encourage organic farmers, knowing that organic farming in many ways is the ultimate in climate-smart agriculture, because the soil is such a significant part in increasing organic matter, and so many of the practices really enhance the kinds of things we're trying to do for good practices for the environment. It really makes a huge difference that this particular rule is moving forward and being finalized.
The new rule will take effect in about 14 months, but producers will have up to 5 years to make whatever changes to facilities that may be needed in order to comply and to be certified as organic. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. In partnership with USDA-accredited certifiers, USDA's National Organic Program will actually oversee the implementation and enforce the compliance of these new, more consistent standards. The final rule is being published in the Federal Register. If you'd like to see a preview, go to ams.usda.gov. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
In today's National Spotlight, President Biden visited Dutch Creek Farms in Northfield, Minnesota, where he announced more than $5 billion in new investments from his Investing in America agenda, which includes the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act. The new investments will advance rural prosperity, economic development, competition, and sustainability. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack joined him on the trip. I spoke with Secretary Vilsack over the phone about the announcement, and I asked him why the president is putting focus on rural America.
I had an opportunity to visit with the president recently, and I explained to him the circumstances that have taken place over the last 40 years or so. In 1981, then Secretary Bob Berglund, Secretary of Agriculture at the time, noted concerns about the focus on productivity in American agriculture and raised and suggested that perhaps this would lead to bigger farms and fewer farmers. And I don't think anybody fully understood and appreciated the level and extent to which his concerns over the next 40 years actually came to fruition. What we've seen is a loss of 437,000 farms since that 1981 report. 141 million acres of land that was at one time farmed is no longer being farmed because of cities expanding. So the question I think that I raised with the president is, are we okay with that? And clearly the president's not okay with it. He thinks there ought to be an opportunity for families to be able to say to their sons and daughters and grandkids, you have an opportunity to do what I've done, which is to farm a ranch and to pass it on to your sons and daughters and your grandsons and granddaughters. When you have a substantial number of farms being lost, the question is why? Secretary Perdue in 2019 suggested it was because the only option in American agriculture was to get big or get out. The president Biden directed me to essentially create another option. And over the course of the last 2.5 years, we've been working to create that other option through climate smart agriculture, through renewable energy, through the development of bio-based products, through local and regional food systems, to more competition with processing, to lower fertilizer costs. All of this is designed to create new opportunities for farmers so that instead of getting big or getting out, they can get entrepreneurial. And the investments being announced today are just a continuation of that strategy to create new opportunities, more opportunities, innovative opportunities, and to improve the infrastructure that will allow those opportunities to really take hold. And I think you're going to continue to see that from this administration.
One of the investments announced was more funding for rural broadband. Secretary Vilsack tells us more.
Well, there are $274 million being announced as part of our ReConnect program. The ReConnect program is looking at improving access to or providing access to high-speed internet. Many communities have access, but it's not high speed. Some communities do not have any access at all. And this program, we're announcing $274 million that will go to projects in 8 states. We think that there will be roughly 36,000 people across those 8 states that will have access to high-speed internet. They'll also have the opportunity to take full advantage of the Affordable Connectivity Program, which essentially enables the individuals to get a tax credit that will offset the cost of a low-cost providing access to the Internet. Now, the way in which this becomes important to farmers in an area that will take advantage of this program is that farmers will be utilizing the Internet for precision agriculture, have a better understanding of the nature of their operation, of the condition of their soil, of ways in which they can significantly reduce potentially the amount of inputs that are required on a particular acre based on data and information they can collect if they have access to the Internet.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How will the El Niño winter weather impact agriculture? Rod Bain tells us coming up on This Land of Ours.
What might the El Niño climate pattern expected to dominate this winter's weather in our country mean from an agricultural standpoint? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey starts with Western water supplies for irrigation, where water storage was boosted by last winter's significant precipitation accumulation. However,
some of the biggest reservoirs, especially those in the Colorado River Basin and in the Rio Grande, remain critically low following a generation of drought going back 20 to 25 years or more.
And El Niño could lead to drier than normal conditions in parts of the Pacific Northwest.
We'll have to keep an eye on the Columbia River Basin and some of the smaller waterways in the Northwest for potential signs of developing drought or intensifying drought.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. For many farm and ranch corporations, the entire capitalization structure is based on equity capital. That's common stock. In fact, the majority of ag corporations have only one class of voting stock. While it's a very simple capital structure, it might be better to use a combination of debt and equity capital, or at least more than one class of stock. When you form a farming corporation, what's the best way to capitalize it? A major issue to be addressed when developing the capital structure is the determination of how much debt and equity capital should be used, and whether it makes any difference to utilize a combination of the two. To properly analyze this issue, it's necessary to understand the factors distinguishing debt and equity capital. Equity carries a voting right, but debt financing does not. While there's a corporate obligation to pay debt holders, the right to annual income of the stockholders is discretionary with the board. Also, debt is for a fixed term, while holders of equity own their stock until the corporation is dissolved or the stock is transferred. When the corporation liquidates, debt holders get priority, but stockholders don't. Each of these characteristics has estate and business planning implications. In addition, it's important not to have too much debt financing in relation to equity financing. A thin capitalization can cause other problems. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Many of our veterans are from rural communities. They come from farming communities, and farming runs in their blood. And many of these vets, after they finish serving, they want to get back into their communities and become a part of that.
At USDA Military Veteran Agricultural Liaison, Munshi Ramdas adds,
veterans make up 11% of the total producers in America.
So what USDA resources are out there for military veterans who wish to enter into or continue farming and ranching? Ramdas starts with the USDA-operated website, farmers.gov.
Take a look at our Get Started Guide, a guide to USDA resources for historically underserved farmers and ranchers and veterans. It's a new multi-agency publication that provides information on assistance and target opportunities available to minority, women, veterans, beginning and limited resources producers.
This also includes details about programs and financial, technical, and administrative support within the Agriculture Department's Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area. For example, through the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Veterans who are beginning producers may be eligible for higher financial assistance and or advance payment to install conservation practices through the Environmental Quality Incentives Program.
While within the realm of risk management,
military veterans who are beginning farmers may be eligible for reduced premiums, application fee waivers, increased insurance coverage, and other incentives for several of USDA's risk management programs.
In total, more than 40 loan and technical assistance programs are available to military veterans entering or continuing agricultural careers on the farm or ranch. And Ramdas says, as USDA's military veteran agricultural liaison,
part of my job is to reach out to these vets and encourage them and let them know what's available to get them back into small town USA to get into businesses or agriculture.
I'm Rod Bade reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Energy markets continue to monitor events in the Middle East while crude oil production here continues near record levels. I'm Mark Oppold with today's bottom line report brought to you by Kloss Equipment and AgriLiquid. Discover the entire lineup of combines, forage harvesters, tractors, balers, and hay tools from Kloss. Visit Kloss.com. Middle East fighting so far has not caused any crude oil supply disruption, while production in the U.S. hit record levels in August. The latest report shows U.S. production at over 13 million barrels per day. That's a new monthly record. Looking at futures, December crude oil nearing an important support level at $81, a close below $80 would be the lowest since August 28. Now, the Middle East, certainly a wild card. Farmers and ranchers may want to consider doing some forward pricing of diesel fuel and gasoline at recent lower levels. This is the Bottom Line Report. Panama Canal Authority says October was the driest month there in over 70 years, and they're reducing the number of vessels that can pass through on a daily basis. That and the possibility of weekend rains in Brazil keeps pressure in the grain trade. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service recently announced funding opportunities available through the newly expanded list of climate smart agriculture and forestry mitigation activities.
The USDA Natural Resources Conservation Services recently announced an increase in climate smart agriculture and forestry mitigation activities eligible for Inflation Reduction Act funding through EQIP and CSP programs in fiscal year 2024. Gail Berry, USDA NRCS National Inflation Reduction Act Coordinator, shares more.
So to support the climate smart agriculture and forestry mitigation activities, our professional conservation planners and partners across the countryside are ready to work with America's agriculture producers one-on-one through what we call conservation technical assistance to meet their conservation goals for their unique operations. We do this conservation planning by coming out to farms and ranches across America and talking with producers about their resource concerns. NRCS has an entire suite of conservation programs to implement this important climate work, including the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, the Conservation Stewardship Program, and the Agriculture Conservation Easement Program. The IRA legislation gave us additional funding for these programs, but did not create new programs. So the names hopefully will sound familiar to you.
That was Will Jordan reporting. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
The second annual Precision Ag Day coming up. For the second year in a row, Chico State College of Agriculture will host the annual Precision Ag Day at its university farm on Wednesday, November 15. Nearly 200 farmers, ranchers, college students, and others connected to the ag industry were able to attend the event and learn about the latest advancements in precision agriculture. Thomas Henderson, a professor with the College of Agriculture at Chico State, said, quote, "We're excited to once again showcase cutting-edge technologies and inform management practices in precision agriculture. This year, we have companies in both plant and animal agriculture to meet the needs of producers in our area." Those companies, including Kirby Manufacturing, On Target Spray Systems, and others, will demonstrate the uses of drones, sensors, automation, and autonomous machinery, as well as electric tractors. In addition to the demonstrations, this year's event will feature a Women in Ag, AgTech panel discussion. Eva Shepherd-Nicole, Executive Director of Chico Start and Chico State Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship, noted that there's a high demand in the North State for a formal community of women in ag and AgTech. She says, quote, "Chico Start, as the North State Accelerate Inclusive Innovation Hub, heard the clear demand and acted on it. We're excited to sponsor this panel event, adding to the College of Agriculture's annual Precision Ag Day. We will cover a broad range of topics from a panel on Precision Ag OEMS, info on local ag accelerator AgStart, and several women entrepreneurs sharing their entrepreneurial journeys in farming and ranching." Attendees are encouraged to register by November 10th. You can find out more information and to register by visiting csuchico.edu.
If you buy organically raised meat and poultry products and you pay the premium price for them, you want to be sure that they are truly organic, certified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Consumer surveys also show that most shoppers who buy organic meat and poultry products also are interested in animal welfare issues, how those animals are raised and treated on the farm. Well, we will all soon have more assurances on that score.
This is the most significant update in organic regulations in over 30 years.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack unveiling for reporters the other day national regulations that will govern the conditions under which certified organic livestock and poultry would be raised. The set of rules has less to do with what producers feed their animals and what medicines can be used on them and such, more to do with how the animals are cared for and raised. For example,
it establishes minimum outdoor space requirements and ready access to outdoors for livestock and poultry. The rule carries forward indoor and outdoor living condition requirements, sufficient space for animals to move freely, bedding that is in a large area, comfortable and hygienic. Specific density with poultry requirements.
When these new rules take full effect, producers won't be able to market their products as certified organic unless they meet those humane care standards, and there will be expert certifiers coming around to check on those farms. And so,
this rule makes organic the gold standard for animal care.
Nate Powell Palm is a Montana organic chicken, cattle, egg producer, also chair of the National Organic Standards Board.
And my customers, when they come to visit my farm, get to see that my hens have consistent outdoor access, they scratch and peck in the soil, and they live a life with dignity. And now, because of this rule, I can point to this rule to spell out how my hens are not unique in the organic market. All organic hens are raised with the highest animal welfare because of the publication of this rule. Every carton of eggs carrying the USDA organic seal in every store across the whole country presents a one-stop shop for consumers now to get both the cleanest food and food raised with the highest animal welfare.
The new rule will take effect in about 14 months, but producers will have up to 5 years to make whatever changes to their facilities that may be needed in order to comply and to be certified as organic. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Today's segment features a conversation between ABC President and CEO Richard Wacott and ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications, Taylor Hillman.
Richard, important time, important things going on right now for the almond industry. And that is this referendum that some people may have heard about. It started October 30th. We had something that went out prior to this voting open window, but that window is now open. Let's talk a little bit about what this is. This referendum, it's a formal rule change, right? What was needed here?
So basically, the marketing order structure every once in a while goes through some changes, either just sort of updating changes because terminology changes and different aspects of process change that aren't really you know, fundamentally different than what the market order has, but they just need to be updated so we're in compliance. And formal rulemaking often is required because you're actually changing some words, you know, updating words, for instance, that are in the order itself. But then there are times where you're actually adding or eliminating a function or a area of authorization that the federal marketing order has. And in this case, we are putting forward in the referendum the request for authority to have borrowing capability at the Almond Board. And this is something that several other marketing orders have done for the similar reasons we are. And that is, it's not to increase the budget, it's not to increase the assessment, it's nothing really to increase overall funding, it's just the timing of the funding. So as our growers and industry members may know, we collect the assessment, the 3 cents a pound, in four phases throughout the year. And a calculation that's based on what crop receipts have been recorded and therefore how much a given handler owes the Almond Board and ultimately the grower. And then we invoice based on that formula. As you can imagine, you know, early on in the crop year, usually the receipts are obviously lower than they are later in the crop year. And so we have sort of this mismatch that's been going on for a number of years, probably sort of ever, but it's been one that's accentuated now in the respect that we've had slightly lower crop sizes than the peak we had, the 3.1 billion pound crop a few years ago. And we have the need to utilize the Almond Board's funds in terms of growing global demand more than ever. And so what this borrowing authority does, again, it's not any increase to the funding, it's just the timing of it, like you would in your own operations where, you know, you have a lot of expenses at certain times of the year, but maybe the income's not offsetting those expenses and you might have a line of credit with your bank to get you through those times when you need that additional financing and then pay it off when you do have that revenue come in. Same thing at the Almond Board. We have a lot of heavy promotional expenses, that's public relations and especially advertising. The media budgets, which are so hefty, largely take place in the fall because we have the new crop, we have Christmas, we have Diwali, which is the huge festival in India. We have obviously the Chinese New Year, which comes just after the first year, and we have the Christmas celebrations in the Western part of the world. So there's just a lot of activity, promotional activity that takes place in a relatively short period of time when we don't have all that much revenue coming in because it's the beginning of the crop year. So what this lending authority will do is allow us to temporarily borrow some funds to maximize our investments at the perfect time of the year when we want to get the most impact on those investments, and that would be primarily during the fall months and early winter months. And then as the revenue comes in later in the year, we would pay down those the line of credit to zero every year and obviously incur an interest expense for doing that, but it would maximize our ability to make the use of funds with our media and driving global demand campaigns as sufficient as possible. So that's what's behind this. There are some other, as I mentioned, some updating things that are included in the informal rulemaking referendum, but the principal item really is this borrowing authority, which, just to reiterate, it does not increase the assessment, does not increase the revenue of the organization at all during the year. It's just a timing issue, like most businesses have, where they have certain times of year where there's more money going out than coming in. And this would allow us to bridge those times with this temporary financing. And again, the board of directors and the finance and audit committee at the Almond Board would dictate how that borrowing authority would be used, to what extent it would be used, obviously when any borrowed funds would be paid back, and have agreed that obviously we will never go from one crop year to the next with the credit line at anything but zero. So anyhow, that's what is taking place over the next 3 weeks or so with the referendum and the ballots that growers will be receiving. And just wanted to help understand or explain what this is about. And again, several other, including the Walnut Board in Sacramento, have this type of authority, as do several other marketing orders.
Yeah, several bullet points that I think are key you mentioned there. I don't think any grower isn't familiar with cash flow, which is what this is looking at. And again, I think a key thing there is it will never go across crop years. This is crop year to crop year. And again, the assessment is not changing.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe I didn't mention the, I mentioned outflow and inflow, which is cash flow and what you have available. Yes, it's really all about managing cash flow in the end. And like, again, all businesses have to do, and the Olive Board has to do as well. And we wouldn't do this if we didn't feel that by having the largest sums that we can based on our annual budget available for investment during during the peak times of year when we want to invest those funds, we wouldn't be asking for this authority. We have to try and do the best we can with the money that is entrusted to us by the growers, and that's what this is all about. It's really, again, trying to make sure that every dollar that we can invest in global market development, we are at the right time, and then again, any cash flow borrowings we need to make to allow that to happen will definitely will be paid back by the end of the crop year.
As you mentioned, marketing activities often pay in advance. Those happen in the fall. And that's the number one priority for the Almond Board, is to drive global demand. And that's why something like this is needed, right?
Yeah. And as the industry is witnessing right now, we have the Deion Sanders campaign, which is, we think, hit the ball out of the park, or made a few touchdowns already in terms of the investment we've made there. And that's a great example of where all that media and all that spend largely is sort of this, August through December timeframe. And so we don't necessarily have the revenue coming in from assessments to fund all that at the same time. So this borrowing authority will allow us to do that more efficiently.
Very good. Growers need to keep an eye out for the ballots that will be mailed out by USDA. Those started October 30th. The voting window closes November 20th. So keep an eye on those ballots. Again, Almond Board of California President and CEO Richard Waycott. Richard, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Brian. We're heading out to a quick break. But before we do, I'd like to remind you again about the Organic Growers Summit that's happening November 29th through the 30th. This summit is designed to provide information vital to organic growers and producers, including an overview of the opportunities and the challenges in the production of organic fresh fruit. If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit organicgrowersummit.com. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Gearing up for Activate 2024. Registration is officially open for the AgSafe Activate 24 conference, taking place February 20th through the 22nd of next year. This conference is for ag employers, supervisors, and ag employees, as well as anyone in between. AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keene with the conference lineup.
We've got a really great lineup. I'm really excited about it. We always invite all the agencies to come. We want to hear from those that are enforcing laws and regs. And so the Kalosha Chief is going to be at our conference this year. We'll also have EPA, DPR, and our Monterey County Ag Commissioner doing a panel together. We have some really fantastic panels that we've brought together. So we've got panels on the workplace violence regulation and things to be thinking about as you're putting together your plans. Also thinking about your workforce. And as we're finding more of our senior level management that is retiring, how do you go about, putting together a succession plan? We talk about succession planning for the very top level most of the time, but we forget about this really important middle layer of our operations. And these people have been with us for, 20, sometimes 30 years and hold all that knowledge. So how is that knowledge getting passed down? How do teams come together as that transition happens? So we'll be talking about that. And we've got some technology sessions. We're going to be talking about drones and the new regulations around that. So we've got a really fantastic set of sessions that we're offering, more than 40 in English and Spanish.
To register and get a more in-depth look at the schedule, visit agsafe.org. El Niño winter weather and impacts on agriculture. With El Niño climate conditions expected to last all winter long, what does that mean for possible impacts to our nation's agriculture? USDA's Rod Bain talks with USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey in this next report.
What might the El Niño climate pattern expected to dominate this winter's weather in our country mean from an agricultural standpoint? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey starts with Western water supplies for irrigation, where water storage was boosted by last winter's significant precipitation accumulation. However,
some of the biggest reservoirs, especially those in the Colorado River Basin and in the Rio Grande, remain critically low following a generation of drought going back 20 to 25 years or more.
And El Niño could lead to drier than normal conditions in parts of the Pacific Northwest.
We'll have to keep an eye on the Columbia River Basin and some of the smaller waterways in the Northwest for potential signs of developing drought or intensifying drought.
El Niño is also expected to lend itself to favorable conditions for winter wheat and livestock for most of the country this winter. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. We're reporting for AgNet West Radio Network. I'm Danielle Lino.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.